I'm talking today with Robert Commande, who for almost 30 years was the classical music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle here in San Francisco, California. And the question I most want to ask you, Bob, is why did you decide to become a critic? Were you beaten as a child? Did you? Did your parents not love you? Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 355, Classical Music Critic. Robert Commande is the founding editor of the San Francisco Classical Voice and for almost 30 years was the classical music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Bob's an old friend, so when I was in the Bay Area earlier this month, I persuaded him to let me talk to him about the life of a critic, the role and function of criticism, and how he transitioned from being a conductor and lecturer at the University of California at Berkeley to become a critic in the first place.
It was actually an accident. It came over the transom. I had resigned from my 13 years at the University of California, and I was at home with a wife and two children to support and nothing to do. And one day I got a phone call, and it was from my predecessor, a distinguished critic, Alfred Frankenstein, and we knew each other socially, but not that well. And long and the short of it, he was going to get out of music and stay in art and wanted to find someone who could replace him in music at the Chronicle. So I bit. And the reason it appealed to me is that I always thought of the newspaper, never mind criticism, I always thought of the newspaper as a kind of theater. Every day the curtain goes up and you're on. Oh. And that theatrical aspect of the newspaper always intrigued me, but without my thinking that I ought to make a career of it. So then a few months later, I started in on a trial basis, and one thing led to another, and then I did succeed him, and lived happily ever after. It happened to be in the golden years of the Chronicle, and that experience was a blessing because those almost 30 years were joyous.
Wow.
And thoroughly fine.
So you didn't, had you been a journalist at all?
Never.
Prior? No.
Never. When I was in high school, I wrote one or two humor columns, and not in college at all, and I really had no writing experience, and when you get into it that way at middle age, I mean, I was 40 something, and when you get into it, you're seized with a writer's block. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, pacing up and down and pacing up and down, and good old Payne Knickerbocker, who was this distinguished gentleman who looked the way his name sounds. And he was the drama critic, and he was in the next desk over, and he saw me pacing back, and they gave me the best advice I ever had in two words: don't press. Mm. And I never forgot that.
Mm, relax, zen, yes. Now, I have to ask then, did Alfred Frankenstein look like his name?
Not at all. Not at all. He had a wonderful sense of humor, and he wrote with a distinguished style, and he had a humorous touch.
Okay.
That was delightful. He was a wonderful writer and a good lecturer in art, especially. So I learned from him by example, but not by anything he ever said to me.
Okay.
The only thing he ever said to me was after he read something of mine, he said, "That's the best thing you ever wrote." Well, he said that so many times that it was kind of meaningless, but it was good. It was nice, you know.
But also, you weren't just some chimp off the street either. You know, you came to it with extensive music background. What was your job at Cal?
Well, at Cal, I both taught and I conducted choral groups, and I taught different courses in the music department. But I had been in music all my life, I mean, since the age of five. And when I was in junior high school, I went to Juilliard School of Music. and then all the way through into high school, I would go to Juilliard School. And then when I went off to college in the summers, I would come back and go to the Juilliard School. Okay. And then after the war, after my duties as a soldier, in which I actually did a lot of conducting on the side as a, you might say, a hobby in the Army, I organized a men's glee club everywhere I went, did a musical in the Army. But that was always on the side. That was not my primary job. Then after the war, I got out and went back to Juilliard as a graduate student. Okay. For a year.
Did your love of or appreciation of music change as a result of now having to write about it as a job?
It intensified. It worked out differently because then when you go to a concert as someone who has to write about it, you have a responsibility towards that performance. I believe that any listener in the audience has a responsibility to the music he's hearing, but the critic has to write about it.
Yeah.
So I got to the point of doing it over and over again that I felt, you know, very responsible to the performance, and it took me a long time to get over that after I retired.
Oh, after you retired. So even after you retired, you were still responding to and thinking how you would write about it.
Yes, I was still thinking that way.
Wow.
But it really does intensify your experience wonderfully. It's like, you know, the story about the impending noose wonderfully concentrates your mind. Well, when you're on a deadline, you know, you think hard about something. And I had to learn how to handle that because I had to learn I didn't ever write after a performance. I did initially. Mm-hmm. But when the deadlines got moved till noon the next day, then I would do it in the morning. I would forget about it, go home, sleep, and then when I was shaving in the morning, the thing would fall into place, and then it would work.
Yeah, thoughts while shaving are some of my favorite thoughts.
That's right. And what I learned about writing, and what surprised me is once I got into a rhythm and writing became less of a pressure and difficulty for me, and it got to be more of a ready skill. And people commented that they liked my writing, and they seemed to go. But I never realized how I did it or where it came from until many, many years later, and I'm talking about relatively recently, when I realized that it came to me because I was a great letter writer. Mm. And when I read the letters I wrote as a young person, I could see the style that I use when I became a music critic. And then I realized that journalistic writing is the epistolary style. You're writing a letter. You're writing a letter to your readers. And you don't think about the readers. You don't visualize them. You don't. In fact, I never visualized anybody sitting down and reading what I wrote. And I was always kind of surprised when someone would comment about it. And that was true. That is true generally of many journalists. I know that Herb Kane and Art Hoppe and others who were famous and famously read by thousands. And if you mentioned to them, I liked your column yesterday or what you wrote about so-and-so, they'd look surprised and have to be reminded what it was.
Right.
And oftentimes when someone said, I liked your piece last Sunday, I'd say, what was it about? Because you've gone on.
Yeah.
You've gone on to the next piece.
Yeah.
And that's like performing on stage. I mean, the performance you did last night is behind you.
Right.
And the next day is what counts.
Right. It's one long letter that you're constantly writing.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Did you ever have a specific person at the other end of the letter that you were talking to? Did you ever have a viewpoint that you felt you had to uphold, or was it just all a personal reaction to what you were hearing and seeing?
No, I never thought of myself writing to anyone, and certainly not to the performers. I never assumed or believed that the performers whom I reviewed would act on what I wrote. Let's assume I made some constructive remark, or they would think it through again if I said he played this piece too fast. Whether he would, I never stopped to think that anyone would, any performer would take it silly. And only a few performers ever came back to me, either to complain or otherwise. Right. And I never wrote for the performers, and I just wrote to write. And who read it?
Yeah.
You shoot the arrow into the air, and where it falls, nobody cares.
Right.
So it's not about... You weren't providing a shopper's guide. It's part of a conversation about the art.
Exactly. The function of a critic, and early in my career, and I was involved in the Music Critics Association, and we would have forums and symposiums and public things with people on the stage talking about the purpose of music criticism, and you can't believe how pompous that got.
Yeah, I can. Strangely enough, I can.
And they would argue about different aspects of it. And a lot of essays have been written by critics and about critics and by other people criticizing critics about the function of criticism. Mm-hmm. And I boil it down to a very simple one sentence thing about the purpose of criticism, whether it's music criticism, dance criticism, art criticism. The purpose of the critic is to engage his reader in the experience. And if he is informative in the way that he throws light on the composition or on the style of performance or the manner of the performance, and that stimulates the reader to think about it and makes him think, I maybe should hear that again, or I'll buy a recording of that, or if it makes someone who didn't go to the performance feel, well, next time maybe I should go. That sounds interesting. I think that's the function of the critic. And ideally, the critic's purpose is to make himself redundant, to make himself unnecessary. So that if you are, in a perfect world, if you could be 100% effective in engaging your reader in the experience, then the reader becomes his own critic and he doesn't need you.
Hi, I'm Chris Rawson, chairman of the American Theater Critics Association, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? Our fall of 2013 kicked off last week with performances of The Complete World of Sports Abridged in the U.S. and The Complete Works of William Shakespeare Abridged Revised in the U.K. Our U.K. tour, The Complete Works, continues through the first week of December. Plus, we'll be performing Shakespeare, The Ultimate Christmas Show Abridged, and the new show, The Complete History of Comedy Abridged, around the U.S. and in Hong Kong, Singapore, and Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information.
One of the interesting things that's happened to me, and it's increasing in my later years, is that a day or 2 days after a performance in which I've been very much engaged, I hear it in my head. I hear the performance in the correct key. I hear the piece, and this is, to me, this is the ultimate revivifying of the experience that one hopes that reading a review and someone might describe a musical composition or a performance in such a way that the person, in a sense, has a feeling for that experience and maybe not actually hears it, but says, well, yes, it was like that.
You know? Yeah, that's I never believe actors or artists who say they don't read reviews. Why wouldn't they? Of course, you want to be part of the conversation, even agree or disagree.
Once I interviewed Birgit Nielsen in the San Francisco Opera House at noontime, and I offered to take her to her motel or her hotel afterwards. And she accepted, and we got in my car. And in the course of the trip, I said, you know, tell me, at this point in your career, you've been at the peak of the profession. Did you bother to read the reviews? And she looked at me, and she said, look, she said, well, I have colleagues that say they never read the reviews, and we see them getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and going out and get the paper. Yeah. It's just like the person that went to the performance of the amateur or the average listener that goes to the performance, and the next day he wants to read about it just to revivify or to re-experience what he invested in. And so I think a performer has to be curious,
yeah,
about what other people's reactions were.
I agree.
No matter how egotistical they are,
yeah,
no matter how if they felt they didn't do well, especially,
yeah,
they are really curious to know if it wasn't that bad.
Right. Well, and also, I would hope that they wouldn't want to be, at the very least, ignorant of what's being said.
No, not that they can do anything about it.
Right.
And again, I don't really feel that what I wrote ever changed the performer's point of view or his approach to anything. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Maybe it's, you know, I pick up gems from colleagues when I read some of the better reviewers and appreciate what they say. My favorite critic at this point, by the way, is Alastair McCauley, the dance critic of the New York Times. And there's never been a critic that I have been more devoted to and more particular about reading. And everything he says, I take something away with, because he has a way of describing the dance that brings it alive. And that's a trick, because after all, it's such an ephemeral art. It's maybe more ephemeral than music, because after all, music can be recorded and replayed. And dance, well, it can be videoed, to capture the essence of a gesture of an element in a dance, so that you sense what happened, that's wonderful.
What are some of the standout performances over the years that stick in your memory? Any?
You know, I if I'm not with the lady I love, I'm in love with the lady I'm with. You know, it's
right.
It's, you know, there have been so many high points.
Yeah.
And it goes back, because I'm a very old man, and I saw the first performance, the first production of Porgy and Bess, and heard, you know, famous celebrities, Fritz Kreisler, Joseph Hoffman, you know, all kinds of people that were, you know, a century ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so another thing about some of my colleagues who recall Lily Pons and this, or Kirsten Flockstad and that, it had happened 40 years ago, and I'm saying to myself, come on. You know, I mean, what you are recalling is the effect of that performance on you. You're not a recorder. You didn't actually memorize that sound, that thing. You know what that performance did to you, and that's what you remember.
Right.
So if another performer does something similar to you, you can think that this person has this kind of talent,
right,
comparable to Flogstad's, because she could do this similar thing.
So you are continuing, even in your dotage, your anecdotage, to not press.
Yeah.
You're in the moment.
Right, that's for sure. And it took me a long time. My early years as a writer were difficult, you know, because you had to learn how to get into that conversational mode. Well, as I say, it's like being an actor on the stage. It's, you're out there, and you can't flinch.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Check out San Francisco Classical Voice, the go-to place for great music in the Bay Area, at sfcv.org, where Bob Commande continues to write reviews in addition to many other reviews, previews, online streaming, and free music downloads. Go to sfcv.org. Then send us your reactions to continue the conversation via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, ReducedShakespeare.com. Thanks as always to webmaster Matt Rippey, copy boy Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout out this week goes to Karen Dunlop. No reason, it's just random. A special thanks to my very old friend Bob Commande for doing this with me, and special thanks to Chris Rawson, and thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 355, 1065ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Thank you so much for talking to me, because I think this is truly the first time I've ever interviewed an authentic Eminence Grease.
Well, I've never been called that before, although I've reached the age point that it might justify that.
Now you're more of a greasy Eminence.
Yeah, right. There you go. There you go.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.